Hello? Where am I?
Greetings, Mr. Segundo. We have only weeks before they shut this place down, so we'd better be quick.
Why am I here?
We're here to correct you.
Correct me?
Yes, that's right. Do you remember what you learned in school?
You're here to tell me that 2 + 2 = 5?
Nothing so pedantic. Let me ask you something, Mr. Segundo. How many planets do you think there are in the solar system?
Ah, well, let's see. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Jupiter, Saturn, Pluto, Neptune. That makes 9 planets.
Wrong answer, Mr. Segundo.
But there are 9. They told me that in school.
Wrong. Apparently, you didn't get the memo. Guards, apply the electrodes to this man's nuts until he provides the correct answer.
Okay, so I'm here with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is most recently the author of The Pluto Files. Neil, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to chat. First off, I want to go ahead and ask you a follow-up to something you said at the Great Planet Debate. You commented...
Did you attend or only catch it online?
I only caught it online, okay. I'm afraid. But you said that the word planet has surely outlived its usefulness. The time has come for us to create a fresh and sensible classification system from the ground up, one that applies to all objects of our own solar system, yet is flexible enough to embrace newly discovered objects elsewhere in the galaxy. Now,
couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah. But this was several months ago, and I have to ask, well, have you brainstormed on what a sensible and fresh classification system might be to replace the current one?
Or? I'd actually imagined devoting a few weeks to this, and then other commitments landed in my lap. And so I actually haven't given it the brain attention, the brain power that I had hoped I would at the time I announced that at the debate.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm professionally a galactic astrophysicist, galactic and extragalactic astrophysicist. So it's really not my place to jump into the solar system where there are many active people, not only planetary astronomers, but planetary geology.
Yeah.
Planetary geologists who have strong opinions about this. So part of me is reluctant to sort of get in their face because this is their world and I'm an observer of it. But another part of me knows that in the galactic universe, we've already been through classification schemes for stars and for galaxies that we're all happy with. And there are many more kinds of stars than kinds of objects in the solar system, at least from a cursory view of what we need to classify at the moment. So I might be able to bring some cosmic insight to the problem, but I haven't given time to it yet, though.
Huh. Well, I mean, the notion of a planet is already problematic. I mean, why even bother with planets at all? I mean, you could have even had just a depiction of the solar system in all of its many objects and the like at the Rose Center instead of just settling on the 8 that created this particular controversy.
Well, we didn't settle on the 8. In the Rose Center for Earth and Space, it's widely sort of stereotyped as showing only 8 planets and counting only 8 planets without regard to what else is in the solar system. But that's not actually what we did. We just reorganized the solar system, combining objects of like properties together. And at the time, more frozen bodies, small with tipped orbits, crossing the orbits of other planets, were found in the outer solar system that looked more like Pluto. And Pluto looked more like them than any one of them looked like anything else in the solar system. So all we did was group Pluto with its brethren in the outer solar system. Then we grouped the gas giants together as a family, and we grouped the terrestrials, Earth, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, together. So the photo, the family photo of the solar system was presented in these groupings. At no time did we recount the planets in the solar system. And in fact, there is no... The word planet is sort of undervalued in the exhibits entirely. Yeah. We prefer to focus on physical properties of these objects rather than try to salvage a word that hasn't been formally defined since before Copernicus.
Got it. Well, I mean, to talk about the notion of introducing this exhibit and not tipping anybody off initially until this New York Times reporter ran with the ball and created something of a media storm... Something of a
just
media
say
storm.
Media storm.
Well,
just,
I like to use reverse hyperbole here.
Okay.
But in the case of this considerable media storm, you didn't tip anybody off. And I'm curious as to, I mean, the sentiment in this book that you expressed multiple times is science is not a democracy. And I'm wondering, though, why you didn't approach the IAU to essentially get them to get with the program that Pluto is not a planet, that it is essentially a TNO, and...
Trans-Neptunian object.
Yes, exactly, exactly. I mean, I'm wondering why you, perhaps you could have smoothed things over a little bit with the IAU before introducing this, or that does the IAU really not matter in this particular group?
IAU cares what the definition of a planet is, and we didn't. It's that simple. We didn't present a case for planethood or not. All we did was say, here's an interesting way to look at the solar system. Put Pluto with the other icy bodies and present it as such. We didn't say Pluto is not a planet. We made no such claims. That was we were widely stereotyped for having done so, and that's the simplest if you don't have the time to read what we did, then that's the simplest thing that people did. There are many interviewers, media, who would come up to me and say, so how many planets are there in your exhibits? And I said, we don't count planets. We just simply don't count planets. So I had no interest in lobbying the International Astronomical Union because they're concerned with the definition of planet. And when they do, fine, define it however they want. It doesn't change sensible ways to organize the information content of the solar system.
But in the minds of people, you had to be aware of the public perception. I mean, in this book, you point to, of course, the Caltech parade in Pasadena, the funerals for Pluto, the endless editorial cartoons and the like. I mean, I actually saw a Discover magazine headline that said Beyond the Nine Planets. That was in a week ago. So people are still struggling with this taxonomy, even though it's clearly not a planet. And I mean, you had to have been aware of this in some sense. I mean, is it really, what kind of adjustment period do we need? I mean, what kind of outreach do we need even to the IAU members, the 10% who voted against the idea that voted for Pluto being a planet?
For retaining its planet
status. Yes, exactly.
A mere 10%, I would add.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, let me make it clear. There are people who have a lot invested in the word planet. Odd, because, like I said, the planet had no formal definition. Not since ancient Greece. When Copernicus, planet means, it comes from the Greek planetes, meaning wanderer, and it referred to the objects in the night sky that from night to night would wander against the background stars. And there were seven of them: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. Did I get to seven there? Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. Seven. That's an unambiguous definition. No argument there, seven planets. Copernicus says, wait a minute, the Sun is in the middle. Earth is one of these other objects that goes around the Sun. The Moon goes around the Earth. So Earth became a planet. The Sun became not a planet. The Moon became not a planet. And so, but even at Copernicus's time, the word planet did not get a formal definition. It was only, well, that seems right, let's just keep it. It was not formally defined until the IAU in August 2006. I'm fine with their definition, because it doesn't matter to me. The word is not useful. If you have a word that in the same breath formally would have had Pluto as well as Jupiter, but I can make the same case with Mercury. Here's Mercury, a small, dense, rocky object in the same category as Jupiter, which is huge, massive, almost a failed star, and they're the same classification? Of what value is that to the person who you tell that they're both planets? If I say, I just discovered a new planet around a star, is it big, is it small, is it gaseous, is it near, is it far, is it hot, is it cold, is it... You have to play 20 questions just to gain insight into what I'm talking about. That tells you that the word planet has lost all value to the scientific enterprise. So we're in need of what I propose, and I don't have lexicon to go with this, but I'm advancing an idea first, which one should always do before vocabulary follows. Is we know so much more about the planets now than we did in the days of Copernicus, when all you could do was say it's a point of light on the sky, put them together into one class. We've been there. We've plunged spacecraft into their atmospheres. We've visited their moons. We've surfed their rings. We've measured their magnetic fields. So set up all the data of the solar system and then take a cut through it in whatever way is sensible for the moment. So let's say today you want to study storms. Mars has storms, Venus has storms, Earth and Jupiter have storms. Put them together in a storm. There's a storm classification where those objects are together. How about liquid water? That'll get you Mars and Earth and Europa. These are the liquid water objects. Put them together for that. That's kind of cool. Rings. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Cool. I like it. Volcanoes. Mercury and Io, one of the moons of Jupiter and Earth. Mars. Dead volcanoes, but it has volcanoes. So you can take a volcano cut, a magnetic field cut, a ring cut, take whatever cut you want and make that the substance of your discussion.
Yeah.
But the moment you start memorizing planet names and think that that's science, there's the delusion that your exam should be, what is the name of the fifth planet from the sun? And you're thinking that you're actually understanding the solar system, but in fact you're not. By the way, I reserved these strongly held opinions for the last chapter of the book, where I give advice to teachers and to parents and the like. The rest of the book is really a celebration of the publics, or the kids and adults and colleagues, fascination with Pluto and the cultural dimension that it brought to bear on the problem.
You also quibble with the New Horizons mission because they had this idea of completing the reconnaissance of the solar system, and you quibbled with the sense of finality in that statement.
That was one of their slogans.
Yeah.
Complete the reconnaissance.
Yeah.
Of the,
yeah.
It's like, excuse me.
Yeah.
We just discovered the Kuiper. We didn't lose Pluto. We gained a whole new swath of real estate in the solar system. Can you think about it that way, please? That's much more scientifically progressive.
Yeah.
Than say, let's complete the reconnaissance. That I was very disappointed in that.
Yeah.
And it's not the right attitude that one should take towards scientific discovery.
But going back to this notion of getting people jazzed up, as you have jazzed me up with your last description about TNOs, about all of this excess real estate that we didn't even know really existed.
We gained a new place.
Yeah.
That's what we did.
How do you get, for example, politicians and the like to start authorizing space money for reconnaissance without looking at it in final terms like this? I mean, is it just a matter of constantly telling people, look, you know, there's more than planets, that there's...
I think there would have been no less thrust, no pun intended, for a mission to the outer solar system had it been couched as... We've discovered a brand new species of objects in the solar system. Let's find out more about them. And by the way, Pluto is the exemplar of them, or representative, or one of the largest among them. That has very strong scientific argument in support of it. To say Pluto's the last planet we've never found, let's go to it. I think it's not giving lawmakers and the public credit for thinking about the value of a next frontier.
Yeah. If you had to choose between Sedna and Pluto as the TNO with more possibilities, which one interests you more?
Pluto, just because it's the nearest among these. These other round objects in the outer solar system are much farther away, and they have much less legacy than Pluto does. So I would stick to Pluto. If I had to pick a round object in the Kuiper Belt to study, definitely Pluto, as the New Horizons mission is about to do in just 5 years.
I also wanted to ask you about your stance on Sedna's orbit. There are a lot of people who are trying to explain it. You have, of course, this idea that it came from a brown dwarf and that it actually gravitated into our solar system. There's a Jupiter mass-sized object. Where do you stand on
Sedna? I don't have an opinion because I don't work in that field, but I can tell you that the field of sort of orbital dynamics and the life span of a solar system is relatively new, last 10 years or so, where we brought the armament of high-performance computing into our understanding of the dynamics of the long-term billion-year dynamics of a solar system. And it allowed us to understand, for example, that maybe the moon was formed by an impact with the Earth, rather than captured or rather than formed from the beginning. It allows us to understand that some asteroids are fragments of other asteroids. As you piece together their spectral signature, you can reassemble pieces of rock that are in orbit around the sun into the whole mass that they once were. You study the fact that on other solar systems, now that there are 300 exoplanets in the catalogs and growing, that many of those have huge Jupiter-massed objects near their host star, quite unlike our solar system. Well, how does that happen? Well, current models suggest that they migrate towards the sun over the lifetime of that star system. And in doing so, they kick other objects out. It's like a dance, like a do-si-do. You can't move in unless something moves out. And this is new ideas about the dynamics of a solar system. So with Sedna and other objects in the outer solar system, I'm intrigued that they could be either captured or possibly in form there from scratch, but not likely. These are all sort of the frontier of decoding the backstory of how the solar system got to look the way it does.
I also wanted to ask you about this issue of scientists who frequently write popular books. I mean, this is both positive and problematic, because on one hand, you're informing the layman exactly what's going on, but at the sacrifice of other perhaps pressing topics. And then there are a lot of scientists who look upon this as, oh, well, it's, hey, I can go ahead and fill my coffers with a kind of get-rich-quick scheme if I just go ahead and have patronizing arguments or just general kinds of descriptions. I mean, is there a certain risk? I know that with a few of your books, you've actually selected the best articles that have appeared on your website, and that this has been a criteria for what actually goes into the book. And I'm curious how you negotiate this problematic realm. What's the best way to negotiate the popular science book?
Well, I don't see it as a negotiation. I can speak personally, and I, if you have other specific examples you want me to comment on, I can. But personally, my book just before the Pluto Files was Death by Black Hole, which was a collection of my essays for Natural History Magazine. My personal favorites, among those that were most highly requested of the ones I had written, and others were filled out what I thought were some scientific gaps that wouldn't have otherwise come in those two lists. And so these, I think, there's a lot of science in Death by Black Hole. Not only science to learn, but how to learn how science works. In fact, I think that's its greatest contribution to the literature. So when you say fill coffers with money, there is no academic who goes into academia to become wealthy. This is not the fastest route to wealth. If you want to get rich, you leave academia, take your formidable intellect that you've honed over all your time in the service of the frontier of the cosmos, and bring it to Wall Street or wherever else. But it's not the place to get wealthy. All of our friends who have left the field are fabulously more wealthy than any of us in the field. So I don't see the risk. The public has an appetite, and they buy according to that appetite. And an appetite for learning, in particular, I know firsthand, an appetite for the universe. And to the extent that I can serve it, I am happy to. And I do. So I don't fully get what you mean by the conflict or to resolve.
I guess that the public may not necessarily understand seminal scientific issues that are going on that might be too complicated, perhaps, for them to understand. That would
sure.
take years of training
that
and the like.
And that can happen.
And also whether they...
Yeah, but so what? But that's always there. There's always some kind of science that doesn't lend itself to popular exposition. That's certainly true. And I may try to step there just to, as an educator, well, how will I do with that? And maybe I'll succeed and find a new paradigm, a pedagogical paradigm, or not, and then I would just fail. But I'd rather try it and fail than not have tried it at all.
Gotcha. I wanted to also ask you about your position on a manned mission to Mars. I mean, as we know, it's perhaps more fruitful to science to have a robotic exploration to collect
Entirely.
Data.
Entirely.
And the cost-benefits analysis of having an astronaut go there, certainly you don't get much return from a scientific standpoint.
That's
Yet
correct.
Simultaneously, well, we look to our astronauts as heroes in some sense. And I'm wondering, the trade-off of this, it's almost as if science gets wrapped around a celebrity culture. How do we negotiate this kind of dualism here?
Well, astronauts are a different kind of celebrity. They're celebrity by the title they carry, not by the individuals who they are. So, for example, at the American Museum of Natural History, we will conduct programs from time to time, and occasionally there's an astronaut. An astronaut is the only kind of celebrity where a person would go up and get his or her autograph without even knowing the name of the person in advance. Just the fact that they've been in space matters to the autograph seeker. And that's a remarkable fact. I don't know any other kind of celebrity for which that's true. It's a respect for what they have accomplished more than a respect for who the individual is. And so that's my first comment there. Second is the science fraction of the NASA budget has never been more than half. In fact, it's never been more than a third. In fact, averaged over the 50 years of NASA, it's been down around 20%. NASA has always been about the manned program. And it's delusional to me and my colleagues to think otherwise. And I know occasionally we do. We think NASA is our private science funding agency and cry foul when money gets spent on some other manned support mission. So it's naive to suggest that if you got rid of the manned program, then all of a sudden there'd be more money for science. The manned program is heavily embedded in American culture, in American definition of itself as explorers, as adventurers, and the like. And no one's ever named a high school after a robot, no matter how popular robots have been. So I submit to you that if you reinvigorate NASA with an active manned program that advances a space frontier, something that's not happened since 1972, over this time we've been boldly going where hundreds have gone before, into low Earth orbit. So if you reinvigorate the manned program, where every next mission is an advance over the previous one, just as what happened in the 1960s, that it would land on the front pages of the newspapers once again. And people would start studying, well, who's going to be the first one to walk on Mars? And there'll be the first Mars astronaut class. And there'd be, the media would be tracking down who their science teachers were and what their hometowns were. All of this, I have no doubt, would be resurrected under such a plan. And that would bring a level of interest in space exploration and the science that surrounds it and the engineering and the technology that surrounds it, that science would ride the coattails of this as it always has. And as the history of scientific discovery has demonstrated, it always will.
Yeah. But now we're facing a scenario on the state level, on the city level, and even on the national level of declining money going towards science. And in fact, I've read that there may in fact be cuts at the Museum of Natural History. So it seems to me that that either you need some sort of promotional tool like the Frontiersman astronaut, or something else to tell people that science is important, the pursuit of science is important. Is there a particular solution, or can you just...
Yeah, there's a solution. The solution is people die broke, and then they learn. Well, what is the what enables the creation of wealth? And the creation of wealth, since the Industrial Revolution, has been squarely in the hands of those who invest in their science and technological future. So, it's in a free democracy. Yes, you can choose to spend your money how you will, but what you need are leaders who have the foresight to recognize that investments in your technological infrastructure, investments in your longer-term science R&D, longer-term we can define in practical terms as having a horizon of return longer than the re-election cycle of your lawmakers. Somebody needs that foresight. Without it, you just go you go broke, you go straight to the poorhouse, because you think to yourself that we have a problem, let's solve it and bring all your resources to bear on that one problem, when that's not what science does. Science doesn't solve today's problem. It solves tomorrow's problem with the moving frontier of its advances. You need engineering to solve today's problem, and it's the two acting in tandem that create the rich foundation on which powerful economies are built. Other countries know this. China knows it very well. India, Singapore, the Far East broadly have come to this recognition in the past decade or so. And we've just been coasting on the investments made in the 20th century on that infrastructure.
I'm curious, have you made any efforts to contact the Obama administration, or have they made any efforts to contact you in relation to this very pressing concern?
I'm not unknown to them, and I've written extensively on sort of the value of, in particular, a healthy and active space program, on the ambitions of a next generation. There are some good people advising him, and I have confidence that they will succeed, and I have confidence that Obama is a smart enough person to respond to this advice. So I'm quite happy with what I've seen thus far. And in these first few days of office, the statements about upping the budgets for the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation are just the kind of investments that the longer term return on, you're investing in the future of your nation, and those are the steps to take. You have to resist the urge to put Band-Aids on all your current problems.
I also wanted to follow up with you on Apophis, which I know that you've delivered a few lectures on the subject, and here we are now wondering if it's going to be either 2029 or 2036.
Well, it won't hit in 2029,
we know this.
Yes.
But there is still a possibility with 2036.
Yes.
There's been some, you know, $50,000 going out hoping for people to study this and find this out.
Which is pennies, of course.
Yeah, pennies, of course. I mean, here we have like a potentially serious threat, and yet it didn't. It's not on the front pages. I mean, what do we do to worry about these things, or get people worried about these things, or should we even worry about something like Apophis?
We need a mission to put a transponder on Apophis so that we know exactly where it is at all times. So it'll beacon to us its location, even when we lose it behind the sun and it reemerges on the other side, as the two of us dance around in orbit relative to each other. So Apophis, if you put a transponder on, and we find it's got Earth in its target, and we can confirm this, I think it'll be front page story every day of the year,
yeah.
Following what kind of investments we'll be making. Are there contributions from other countries? Is it robotic? Is it manned? Do we know enough about asteroid textures to attach something to it? Do we use a gravitational tractor? Fortunately, there are people working on this right now so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel when that time comes. What we need now is a transponder that'll go, and I don't know that that's funded right now, and that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, Neil, thanks very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Wasting time we used to spend around.